So it's a pleasure to be here. So actually, this is only half of the title. It would be too long. And so I will talk about curved surfaces, how they might relate to glasses. And another portion, which is actually not written on a title, is actually how we... What's that? I think so. Let me see. Yeah, it's turned on. Another thing actually wrote, is not mentioned in the title, but of course we'll talk about in detail in the talk, is how we might actually apply the same sort of ideas, but in an inverted fashion. So how we might actually try to solve hard problems that take a very, very long time to solve on the usual algorithms, or at least some algorithms, how we can actually make the dynamics faster on the computer to hopefully have convergent solutions. Okay, so before I run out of time, let me tell you what conclusions are. So conclusions are, which you might say are obvious and trivial, and you'll be right, they're obvious and trivial and intuitive, that's why they're probably right, that if you have constraints, particularly ones I was talking about today are of a geometrical nature, but of course you don't have to, it can be of other nature as well, if you have constraints, they can lead to slow dynamics, particularly I'll argue that there's glass dynamics, but of course it doesn't really need to be glassy, there's some approximations involved, but nonetheless it's slow. And moreover, it also leads to unusual permodynamics. In particular, show that in some subtle limits, it actually leads to a so-called avoided critical point. Okay, so this relates to structural glasses, at least theories, I should say, of structural glasses. You don't really know, many of us have theories about what glass transition really is, including many people in the audience, but there is no master theory that we agree upon. And then I'll actually talk about the opposite situation, in which you want to solve hard problems on the computer, like traveling salesman problem, Hamiltonian cycle, and so on, lots and lots of problems which are very, very hard to solve. Now I'll argue that by removing constraints on the problem, in the way that I'll make more precise later on, we can actually make design algorithms that flow to resolutions more rapidly than you would have done if you just did brute force. Of course, there are many, many genius algorithms out there, but just yet another way of actually doing this. So this is sort of an inverse glass problem instead of the glass problem, so to speak. Okay, so what is frustration? All these systems will have frustration. Many people in the audience have worked on frustrated systems much more than I have. But nonetheless, I should tell in general what frustration means, particularly in the context of condensed matter theory. So the simplest prototypical example of frustration, in particular of examples talked about today are really harder examples, but nonetheless, in a nutshell, they really have the same characteristics that this simple system has. So imagine that you have situation in which your Hamiltonian is the sum, or Lagrangian, as well as you do field theory, is the sum of many, many interactions, each of which would be minimized by some particular configuration. But it's impossible to satisfy all bonds, all interactions simultaneously. So for instance, the simplest example of that, one of the simplest examples, suppose you have an Ising, it doesn't have to be Ising, suppose you have a triangular anti-Ferb magnet, by which I mean across any one of these lines, you would like to have spins on tie a line. So obviously, if you just have two spins, you can easily lower the energy, minimize the energy of a single bond by aligning the spins in a state in which one spin is up and every spin is down. So obviously, you have a situation here which you minimize the interaction of this bond, S times S across this line. But of course, if you have now to consider what happens for this spin, you obviously get different results depending on which one of the two bonds you wish to minimize. If you minimize this bond, obviously you'll set the spin to be down, but if you do that, this bond will be unhappy. And of course, by symmetry, if you want to minimize this interaction, setting the spin to be up, then of course this bond will be happy. And of course, this is much more general. This, of course, will carry into any odd number of a loop, any odd number of basic units. And this actually, these loops are also what actually underlie solving many hard combinatorial problems, is actually the problem that you actually have not a tree structure, a so-called tree structure, but actually have loops that you have to satisfy. But for now, basically, this is what it really is. You cannot minimize all interactions simultaneously. So how does this arise in glasses, or I should say, some theories of glasses? So in some theories of glasses, what we'll actually study, motivated by works of many, many people, essentially is a non-abelian analog of Arnold Bohm phase. The usual AB phase, as most of you know, is associated with the magnetic field. As a particle, the charged particle goes around the magnetic field, it accumulates a phase proportional to the flux for its path in circles. And that phase, of course, in the usual case, is an abelian, just a C number. What you can actually have in these theories for glasses is you have a very, very similar thing conceptually, but with a twist, namely that now the phase is not really a C number, but now it's some matrix, it's really some operator. Of course, what I'm doing here in this talk would be classical systems. Of course, many in spirit, but of course very different. Some of the ideas have been used in many other contexts. I won't talk about those, it's a very different thing. But in what I actually talk about, essentially, the non-abelian analog of Eleanor Bohm phase. And in this case, really the basic things are not the kinetic potentials, but essentially elastic fields, the tensors, things on commute in general, and the more problems. What we'll actually find is that in certain solvable limits of these theories, particularly the easiest to solve, namely the so-called large N model, we'll actually find out that in those cases, we have what I told you about earlier, namely that you can have lots and lots of possible ground states and near-ground states leading to very, very slow dynamics and also unusual thermodynamics. And motivated by that, you can actually suggest fits to see how they actually compare with real data for relaxation times of various known glass formers. And those agree. Of course, it doesn't say that if it agrees that the theory is right because of always fitting parameters. There are many, many theories that give the same things pretty well, but at least it's consistent with it. Okay, so what is a glass? And of course, many of you are working on this and thinking about this from many different points of view and so on. So, but a glass is basically a supercooled liquid. Take any liquid at high temperatures, cool it down slow enough, it can become a crystal. But if you supercool it fast enough, it doesn't get a chance, so to speak, to become an ordered crystal. And it becomes frozen into an amorphous state, which for low enough temperatures essentially becomes frozen forever and becomes a glass. So it's really not solid in the usual sense, it's not an ordered solid. It's a liquid which is essentially just quenched. On the other hand, this liquid doesn't really move very, very fast. So many of you probably heard this myth that if you go to old churches and you can see that window at the bottom of the church is much thicker than window at the top of the church, and so at the top, that's because over time, over centuries and so on, slowly, slowly this liquid oozes down and makes it. That's utterly false. If you compute the time it takes it to actually go down, that time scale is nowhere near centuries or even ages. It's very, very long. So that's probably because of how it was made, or by chance, half of the time it's thicker at the bottom, and so on. But there's nothing to do with it. But at any rate, the glass is supercooled liquid in which essentially the dynamics is frozen, or slow enough that effectively for all purposes it's frozen. So with that definition, so to speak, of what a glass really is, we might ask ourselves, what do we expect a glass to look like on a very, very naive viewpoint? So one that can sort of, what configuration will actually get if we force nature or somebody, a computer, whatever you want to think about, to actually compute or find approximations to low energy states, but don't allow that person, the computer or nature, to actually have enough time to find a true minimum. So you can only find an approximate minimum, not a true minimum. And those approximate minima will be approximate forms of what the glass really looks like on a local scale. So what we will actually find? So that's basically the question, which can be done for easy systems, but of course it becomes harder, the more problems. This is essentially the outline of what this will be. So essentially I'll review the notion of frustration in glasses. This is of course not new, it's been done by many people before us. Talk about gauge backgrounds for understanding. This is again not new, done by many, many different people. Then I'll talk about results that we did which are also not new by now, but this is what we did. But by we, I mean myself and Daniel, Daniel and Stephen Kibbleson, Joe Rudnick, Pascal Vio, and Joe Terjou. But we did. So we actually can derive Lossy dynamics in these systems. And we can actually also show that there's essentially an unusual Fermionics in these systems in the so-called avoided critical point. And you can actually, using that, put a prediction for what the second times will actually be in glasses, and you can compare the experiment, of course, as I told you, doesn't really say much, it just sort of is consistent. So let's go to our definition of what a glass is, right? We said the glass essentially is a situation in which you force nature to compute ground states or approximate ground states very, very quickly without giving it enough chance, enough time to actually do it to find the true crystalline state. So what do you actually expect? So let's start off with a very, very simple model which has all the quintessential features of what we actually expect to have. Let's imagine, to make life simple, we have a potential via the function of separation between atoms, which is a Lennard-Jones type. So it has a very well-defined minimum. It has a hard core, the vertices of infinity, and so on. It goes to zero, of course, when r goes to infinity. The important point for this discussion, it has a well-defined minimum at a particularly unique value of a distance between the centers of my particles. So it's very easy to solve this system. If I have two atoms, I can trivially solve this problem by just placing the atoms, the distance, r minimum apart of each from each other. And obviously, this bond corresponds to a value of v, which is precisely v of r minimum, which by construction, by fiat, is a minimum of interaction. So obviously, I can't do better than that. If I have three atoms, I can place them in an equilateral triangle. All interparticle interactions are minimized. And obviously, I can't do better than that. What if I have four particles? Well, that's not a big deal. I can pull one particle out of the plane, a tetrahedron, in which all sides have the same length. Again, all equal to r minimum. And obviously, this again minimizes the interaction. Each one of the edges corresponds to the interaction of v of r minimum. But the problem is, you can't keep going on forever because of geometry. So imagine if you would like to test laser, you would like to keep doing this for more and more particles. You could do this in the plane, you can generate triangular lattice, but you cannot do this for tetrahedrons for a very, very simple reason. If you look at the opening angle, the dihedral angle of the tetrahedron, it's not 2 pi divided by some integer number, rather it's some irrational number. And therefore what you can actually do is you can pack some tetrahedrons together around a common edge, but if you do that, you see that you have a small opening angle that results because this dihedral angle is 2 pi divided by 6, but not quite 6. Okay. There's this frustration here, and this frustration corresponds, in this case, to the fact that it cannot minimize, as we had earlier for the triangular and for a magnet, all interactions, because as you can see, I just can't do that. I cannot have all these edges equal to r minimum, because geometry does not allow me to do that. In 3 dimensions, for Euclidean space. And those last words, 3 dimensions, Euclidean space, are trivial, but important, because one way of getting around that is by going to higher dimensions, and of course, also changing the geometry. Of course, looking at different curvatures. This is actually a drawing that was done by Jim Sefner years ago. It was actually hand-drawn at the time, and it sort of gives you the basic point here. Okay? So you can actually go to spaces in which you have no problems doing that. Of course, it's all for the fancy. You cannot really have such spaces in real crystals, I mean, real materials, real liquids, and so on. But nevertheless, let's try to ask ourselves, what would happen if we would actually would like to have a situation in which all the edges were equal to r minimum? If we do that, we can actually generate a generalization of the polygon, so-called a polytope, which Cox and Terwin for many, many years. And this is the configuration of a so-called 3-3-5 polytope, which corresponds to how many edges you have, number they have that common edge and so on. And here this corresponds to essentially 120 vertices. And in this polytope, which actually lies on the shell of a sphere that resides in four dimensions, so there's this free sphere residing in four dimensions, all the edges are of equal length. They all can be equal to R minimum. So this is an ideal crystal in four dimensions. Of course, it doesn't exist in real space. Nevertheless, I could theoretically think about it. And on this crystal, on this basic unit, so to speak, not really a crystal, all the interactions are minimized. Now, I could ask myself, does a system really want to veer toward this configuration vis-a-vis the one that really is the ideal crystalline state of a usual liquid, namely, let's say, the FCC lattice, or HDP lattice as well, for a Lennard-Jones liquid having a well-defined distance R minimum. So in the computer, you can actually do that quite easily. That was done years ago. And you could compute how long it takes some particles to reach the ground state on this polytope, vis-a-vis that in flat space, and you find that it is much, much faster. So now, a basic idea that you can actually have in mind, as if you force a system to compute its low energy state very, very rapidly, it might veer towards sections of this unit before it realizes, so to speak, that it can't really test light space. So what really happens is locally, you have cross sections of this higher dimension basic unit, this polytope, but of course there are voids in that because the geometry is just not right. It has to correspond to some curved geometry, which of course we don't really have in Euclidean space. This is our idea. This is essentially an idea that was proposed long ago by many, many people. I'm not sure even who was the first one to think about this. So Jim Sefna worked on this for many years, David Nelson, Subir Sachdev, and actually, I think Toulouse even worked on this much earlier, and Wazeri and Sadok, Widom, and many, many others worked on this for many, many years. I'm not really sure who ascribed the basic idea to, but many of these, all of these guys worked on this. And the basic idea that you can really have is that when you cool a system very, very quickly, it goes to that configuration I just showed you before it realizes it's not good. But then it's too late because it's already quenched. It's a low temperature state and can't really move. It's quenched. So these are all just nice words. You really want to do some calculations. So how do we do a calculation for something that actually encapsulates this basic physics? Let's imagine that we have this ideal curved space. On the other hand, an ideal basic unit in which all interactions are optimized. And then compare the interactions on that unit relative to what I have in real flat space, real liquids. So I have a mass density, and the physical mass density corresponds to what I have in this cartoon on the x-coordinate. And now to each point in space, I ascribe, if those of you who like the quantity, you probably like this, I ascribe a sphere and which has some diameter, which is equal essentially, given essentially by twice R minimum. And fix the R minimum. And I essentially now define a density on the sphere, which essentially is equal to the density at location x, where the sphere touches, the south pole touches the ground, and some solid angle, some direction, u. So the actual physical density corresponds to the density that I have at the south pole, where mu is equal to the coordinate in four dimensions, the direction 0, 0, 0, minus 1. So if I haven't done anything, I just defined some mass density on the line, and maybe even more complicated by introducing these spheres, which somehow can have on them this ideal order. Now I do the following. Now I project, essentially, the mass density I have in the real space onto what I have on this ideal curved template by just making a projection. And I define rho at any given point on this template. Now let's actually compare how well we can actually do on this curved template. Okay? So if I actually would have an ideal situation, I could actually have the mass density here on a sphere equal to the mass density on the line in a way that if I roll the sphere along some particular path, every time it touches the ground, if I have an atom here, it touches the ground here, so I replace an atom as well. So essentially, the mass density will be on the real space will be fixed by the mass density on this high-dimensional sphere. Okay? So to make this concrete, let's write down rho in terms of multiples that we have of mass density. So usually we think about spherical harmonics. We have some multiple moments, QLM and so on. Now we're dealing with SO4. We're dealing essentially with a sphere, a free sphere residing in four dimensions. Now essentially we have more indices. It's S, those of you, the S, which is essentially SC2 cross SC2. So now essentially we have higher harmonics, higher multiples, so-called hyperspherical harmonics, but nonetheless the idea is basically the same. You can write down the mass density at any given point on the sphere as some product of functions which depend only on the angle of where you are on this sphere, which is this, just like you would have YLM, the three dimensions, or harmonics of the angle in one dimension, and so on, times some function depends on the location that you are in space, these multiples. And now let's write down the free energy that we would have for this system. So ideally, if I roll the sphere down, as I told you, everywhere it touches the ground, I place an atom, that would correspond to the same thing as a translation. Namely, what I would like to have is a rotation that I have on the sphere matches with a translation that I have in real space. Okay? So essentially, if you want to be fancy, or if you do gravity essentially, I have to think about power transfer on the sphere vis-a-vis what I have just by moving the coordinate brute force by some amount. If they match, I'm very, very happy. If they don't, that costs me energy penalty. Yeah. Yeah, so essentially, think about a sphere. So let's imagine that I have a sphere on the plane here, and I essentially just roll the sphere along one direction, but I can also roll it along another direction. I can roll it any given ray that you actually specify, I can roll the sphere along that particular ray. Right. Exactly. That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. So what I do essentially, I make a small segment of a projection. I draw a small circle on the plane, make a projection onto what happens on the sphere, and then I compare what actually happens by rolling the sphere along a given ray vis-a-vis actually translation by the same amount on the same ray. Right, so this is just I can draw better. Unfortunately, my drawing skills are limited. But really, think about, so I would probably be better if I brought here a big sphere and I would roll it on the plane. But again, would correspond only two dimensions. So imagine you have a free sphere in four dimensions and I would roll it along different directions, which of course we can't do physically here, but you can't think about, of course. Many of you have worked on high dimensions, the topologies of high dimensions and so on. So we can think about it, of course. Okay, so I want essentially translation, which essentially is given by the generator, of course, of the derivative. I equal essentially what I would have by rolling. So this corresponds to a generated rotation in a zero new plane. The zero plane is a new fictitious axis that I have going from the north pole to the south pole. And these new just correspond to the actual physical directions, X, Y, and Z. And if I could actually have a situation in which I roll infinitesimally by some amount along any given direction, mu, and that would match by what I would have by rolling the sphere. So rolling the sphere by an angle which is given by that translation by kappa being one of the radius of a sphere, if they would match, this derivative would be equal to zero, and of course the square would be zero. So, of course, if you look at this Lagrangian, this form, what you have here, this is, of course, what many of you encounter, will encounter, with beams here. What you have, a minimum coupling between some gauge field. In this case, not really a gauge field, but nevertheless, it's some non-Biot entity living here, coupled to some so-called matter field, this quantity here, these multiples that really depend, that have some functional dependence on location and space. Okay? And so this really looks a lot like, and really is in essence, a system of charges, but now these charges are really multiples that correspond to higher groups and so on, but who cares? Basically, in essence, it corresponds to some charges coupled minimally to these generators, which are non-abelians, which just tell you how you generate the rotation, a rolling operation of this high-dimensional sphere. And the basic point is, I should emphasize it already here, that these are non-abelian. So if I had a line here, and that comes to the question that you asked me earlier, if I had a line, I would have no problem. I can actually generate, I can put points along this line, I can choose n atoms to put along the line in such a way that n times the arc distance between two points is equal to 2 pi times r, and if I choose it right, 2 pi r is equal to some n times a, n the different integer, I can roll this disk along a given line, that everywhere it touches the ground, there's an atom there, to put an atom on the ground, and there's no problem. This first term that I would have here, this one, will always be zero. But in higher dimensions, there's a problem, because rolling operations, rotation operators, as we all know, do not commute. And so you can satisfy what happens along one direction, but you cannot do it along more than one direction, which, of course, corresponds to non-commutivity of rotations. So let me go back here. So coming back to our example of a triangle anti-ferromagnet, where we actually had some closed path, and we saw we had a paradox, so to speak, if you want to minimize all interactions. The same thing also happens here. Imagine if you draw a simple closed loop, let's say this plaquette, this closed square loop that you have on the plane, and take this high-dimensional sphere and just roll it along one direction, along x direction, along y, then along like minus x, minus y. If you compute what the final state is after these rolling operations, you see that it does not agree with what you had initially, because you have to multiply it by e to the power of I, L, 0, 1 here, let's say, times A. Then you have to do the same thing along the two directions, then along minus 1, minus 2. And because the generators do not commute, this quantity here will be non-zero, because these satisfy a non-trivial algebra. Essentially, we have a non-abelian, I don't know, bone phase coming into the game. We have here some prefactor. This prefactor is not a number, it's not a C number. It's some operator. And this is all classical. There's nothing quantum going around here. But if you see, it just corresponds to rolling operations that you have from this ideal template. So we don't commute, and that's why we have this problem. So I assume you saw this, you see, you know, this. So basically, most of you are students. Of course, this corresponds to the fact that if you make rotations, or rolling operations, if you want to think about them, along the different axes, then the order matters, and so you do them along the direction this way, vis-a-vis that way, you'll get the same answer. So a product around the closed loop is not one. The generators do not commute. Okay, so now let's sort of solve this system, and that's basically what I did, in the large and limits. Of course, it's a very hard system to solve, so you can try to solve it in the limits in which the number of components that you actually have is very, very large. In this case, the number of components means the number of components that you have for the multiples. So basically, you have to find a spectrum, you have the diagonalize and so on, you have some set of eigenvalues, and what you actually find is that the eigenvalues, as you expect, will depend only on this, because the whole system here is rotationally symmetric, it will depend only on the modulus of wave numbers. So the whole system is translationally invariant. It really doesn't care about where you are in space, so to speak. And it's also rotationally invariant. There's no particular ray direction which is preferred. And what you actually find is that you have entire shells along which your eigenvalues have their minimum. And those do not correspond to the usual case. Most theories, most canonical theories that you'll consider, have a well-defined minimum which occurs at sort of uniform state, or so-called k is equal to zero, wave number zero, uniform state, or so-called pi pi or pi pi pi, which is just a fancy way of saying that you have some staggered order as you go by one unit lattice along each one of the directions, lattice directions. Here what you actually find is that you have an entire shell of modes. And unlike the case that some of you considered earlier, in this situation there's a frictional symmetry. So there's no lifting of the symmetry by some fluctuation. The whole thing is really symmetric. And all these points on the shell have the same value for the eigenvalue. They have the same energy cost, so to speak. But what can happen is that minimum occurs for particular points on the shell. And you can compute what happens with the minimum large minimum. And you find basically that the so-called propagator, I won't really be that technical here, but just in a nutshell, it has this form. It has essentially a minimum occurring on some shell. You can calculate the entropy for this. You find that it's very, very large. There are many, many competing states. You can show that that actually leads to essentially very, very long relaxations because it had a very, very large computer entropy. And you can derive with that the local photodynamics. Essentially becomes glassy. There are some approximations involved. Essentially, dynamical mean field approximations and so on. But nevertheless, if you just want to solve it in the easiest way, this is what you can actually get. Moreover, if you actually look what happens within the ground state, you find out that the number of ground states goes exponentially with the perimeter of your system. So if you have a system of size L by L by L and so on, then so if you have a system in D dimensions, then the entropy that you actually have is zero temperature, the number of ground states that you have. The logarithm scales like the area. So it's a holographic entropy, but of course, it's nothing that profound here, just there are many, many possible states, which arise from the fact that within the ground state, you can populate any one of these modes for an arbitrary weight. All you have to care about is that overall your system is normalized. Okay, so I won't delay with the details, but basically what you find is that TC, the present temperature we actually have from an order state to this order state, in this case, is zero. So of course, in flat space, you would have a real crystal appearing below some real temperature, a fine value of TC in high dimensions, d larger than 2. But in this case, because of frustration, all of a sudden, TC drops down precipitously to zero. It doesn't really matter how small this coupling is, how small kappa is, how large radius is of your sphere. As long as kappa is non-zero, as long as you have some curvature, no matter how small, TC goes down to zero immediately. And what you find is the phase diagram is of this nature. This is temperature axis. This is a frustration axis. This is one over radius of a sphere. And you see that if you have no frustration, you have a fine value of TC, which is characterized here by this asterisk. When you turn on frustration, it goes down to zero, or in other cases in which you have a visual interaction, it doesn't go down to zero immediately, but there, nevertheless, there's a finite jump of what you have between TC here and TC here. The transition is avoided. So if you would cool down the system, your liquid here, it would crystallize at this point. To do it here, it doesn't crystallize. It only crystallizes, so to speak, here, has a transition here. But nevertheless, you avoid this point by a small margin if your value of kappa is small. You could have an avoided critical point if you just cool your system down and you narrowly miss this critical point. And you might ask yourself whether there's some physical ramification for this thought experiment. I should say again that all this essentially physically comes from the very, very large degeneracy that you have lots and lots of energy states. That's why the system is so unstable to fluctuations, and that's why TC goes down all the way to zero or other low values if you have additional interactions. So, for instance, you can ask yourself, can you actually scale away from this temperature. So if I do an experiment, in the usual case, as many of you know, I can do measurements of magnetization, stability, for spin systems, and corresponding quantities for other systems. But is there a scaling for various quantities, specific heat, and so on, depending on how far away I am from this point? So usually, as it would cool down, things would depend only on how far away I am from this critical point. Is there an analog of what happens here? So is there some function that tells me that various quantities that I can actually measure are functions of the real temperature that I have minus Tc when the frustration is zero? Namely, this distance that I would have between my actual temperature and this asterisk. So here's an ansatz that we had. The derivation is not rigorous, of course. There's some arguments for it, but the derivation is not rigorous. I should tell you that up front. And the ansatz is as follows. If you look at relaxation time for glass formers, they can be written down as some constant times the so-called Arrhenius form, which basically means e to the power of some free energy function divided by temperature. But now this free energy function is not independent of time, of temperature, but has the following form, essentially some constant plus another constant times the reduced temperature, some quantity telling you how far away you are from Tc if you didn't have frustration. The whole thing raised to some power, which is, in this case, 8/3. And this form is derived very, very well. So here's a reproduction of what we had. And as you can see, it doesn't look that good. That photo doesn't look that good. But it actually looks pretty well. And it works for many, many glass forms. You cannot read. I cannot even read from here. But basically, you get the point. The scaling actually works pretty well. Of course, it doesn't prove that this actually is the real thing, by no means, but it actually does work. Now you can actually ask yourself if you can compare fit parameters with actual theory. So what would that correspond to here? So one of the fit parameters that we have in the theory, which basically corresponds to when I would have a transition, to the value of T that I would have here, is this temperature. At what temperature I would have had a transition if the frustration were turned off to zero. So I can compare basically that transition temperature to what I have for real crystals, the real metric temperature, and I can look at the relative difference. Now if I compute the energy, the cohesive energy that I have for a real crystal versus a part of this basic unit that has high dimensions, I can see that that ratio on this ideal crystal, of course, this increase of energy is, of course, an absolute value lower. The system is actually more stable because all interactions are minimized, but not by much. It's larger by 8%. On the other hand, if I look at all the glass formers, of course, for each one of them, the values to star relative to melting can vary dramatically, as you can see. But overall, on average, it's not that far off the multi-dimensional theory. Of course, I should say that many of the real glass formers are long, ugly molecules. Lots of complications are involved. If you really expect a simple theory like this to really work that well, but on average, it is consistent. It doesn't really prove anything, but it's consistent. So that just comes from the fact that I told you earlier. If you compare the energy of these basic units, of the configured units that I have, with the energy of a real crystal, the relative difference is not very large. 8%, and that difference is very close to what you have for the average value of the shift in T star. Okay, so these are essentially the conclusions. If you have constraints, they can be gravity dynamics, energy phenomics, you can have voyage phase transitions, you can have relaxation times, we scale non trivial way with temperature, and you can have lots and lots of possible ground states. So now let me change gears and talk about possible application of this for real problems which might be useful for various computer science, physics, chemistry, social problems. Yeah, so that's actually the architect of a large N approximation, which I probably should talk about, but basically in a nutshell, is in large enough approximation, all you care about is all normalizations. So you can actually have an arbitrary weight for each one of these points that you have in K-space. The number of points you have in K-space goes like the area. So you can populate any one of these modes with an arbitrary weight. The only thing you have to worry about is over normalization. And the number of modes that you actually have goes like L to the power of D minus 1 is one constraint, and that's basically the origin of that. But I can tell you more when you get around. So I actually go to see what happened in high dimensions, how we can use this for applications. So let me sort of outline the remaining quarter hour of what we have left. Talk about a general idea, then apply it to some hard problems. I talk about the largest click problem, which is something called empty-complete problem. And I talk about application to an easier problem, but a more useful problem, which is the problem of finding communities in graphs. So basically, I'll tell you about two methods for attacking these problems, which rely on going to higher dimensions. So the basic idea, as I'll repeat again in the next many minutes, we had problems, we had glassy dynamics in low dimension because of constraints. Now we can sort of do the opposite. We have slow convergence, let's go to high dimensions and allow the system to better find its minimum if it's not as constrained. We can do this in continuous space or in discrete space. And we actually find pretty good results. So these results that we actually find don't have many problems that some usual methods do. So usual methods have a so-called limit problem, which I won't have a chance to talk about in a minute. And actually, these methods are very, very accurate. You can go in a very, very large system. You can actually go to systems that basically have over 1 billion nodes. And you can actually have very, very, for those edges, you can have very, very accurate results. So it's very, very fast and very, very accurate. And it's much faster than serial mirroring. And it actually does even better than serial mirroring. So this is the idea. Remove constraints and make the system go to its ground state much faster. So essentially, it's like a freezing problem, but now you're freezing high dimensions, and you don't get jammed into a classic state. You have less constraints, and you have faster dynamics, OK? So that's basically the idea. Let's apply this to a problem which you cannot read here. This is from a website which the claim has, so you know about the so-called Millennium problem. So if you can solve any one of these mathematics problems, you get $1 million. And one of these problems is proving or disproving that P is equal to empty conjecture. And I should tell you what these conjecture is. So a problem which is P can be solved and, of course, also checked in polynomial time. Time scales polynomially in the system size. The problem that is NP can be checked in polynomial time, but generally cannot be solved in polynomial time. And people believe, and for good reasons, that the two classes are different. It's much easier to check problems than to actually solve them. And so if you can prove that they're not the same, or that they are the same, then you solve the problem. And one of these problems is the so-called Euler's click problem, which is written here, but of course you cannot read it here. Let me tell you what the problem is. Essentially, it's a tale about a dean. And he has to solve a hard problem. He or she has to solve a hard problem. And the problem is that you have 400 incoming students, and you have a dorm that can house 100 students. And you must put in that dorm, or you can't put in that dorm, 100 students out of the 400. So you might say it's a piece of cake. Just take the first 100 students, put them in there, and you're done. But life is not easy, because each one of these students has problems with other students. So say student number one, let's call him John. He detests lots and lots of students. He cannot share a dorm room, let alone the dorm itself, with 170 other students. And student number 400 is even worse. He or she cannot be in the same dorm with 260 students. Of course, you have to find some configuration out of all of these students which is somehow mutually satisfiable. So in terms of a graph, you can think about all of these students as nodes. And your task, if you're the dean, is to find out the click in that big graph, or 400 nodes, composed of 100 students, 100 vertices, all of which are interconnected. So they're all, so a line means that the students are compatible. No align means it won't work. They just don't like each other. So you have to find out the click of maximally interconnected nodes. You see, all these points are connected to a lot of points. This is connected to all these other points. 100 students, 100 nodes in this big graph, or 400 nodes. So, of course, if your main solution is very easy, but of course, if you have only a few solutions, it's not so easy. So you might say, just go ahead and do it. Don't be shy. Just go ahead and do it. If you're lucky, of course, you can do it. Or if you have many, many solutions, of course, you'll find them. But if you're only a few solutions, then you are doomed to fail, unless you happen to be very, very lucky. Because if you just look at how many possibilities there are of choosing 100 students out of 400, it's a very, very large astronomical number. No pun intended. So of course, you can try to take somebody that likes many, many other students and they keep going. But at some stage, there'll be some conflict and you have to start again and again and again and again and again. And you won't succeed if you just do it brute force this way. So the dean has a problem, and he has to solve this problem. So how should he get about to solve this problem? So he said, no, I don't want to break my head on this problem. Let the students fight it out. So that, he takes them all into a big stadium, and he tells them in the morning, he tells them, if you like somebody, pull him or her in. If you can't stand somebody, push him or her out. Then I'll come back, and I'll see who's left, and those will be the students that I should take into the dorm. But, you see, that is a good idea, perhaps. It doesn't cost him any work, so to speak, but it's not going to work, usually. Why? Because of low dimensionality. So imagine, for instance, that you had one good student, would have been part of the solution, so to speak, but he or she is placed close to the boundary of the arena. And a small push pushes this guy, person, out of the arena, and then he or she is lost forever. You can also have, so you see these red dots correspond to good students, so to speak. You also have a situation where you have good students surrounded by bad students that nobody actually likes. If these bad students are pushed out, then also these good guys, which are quenched, stuck in the middle, they're also pushed out, and it's not a good thing. So essentially, in low dimensions, in this two-dimensional arena, you cannot solve this problem this way, unfortunately. Because you can see you have shielding effects, and there's also biasing that you have with initial conditions. So what to do? So now, let's imagine we go to high dimensions. So this is a way of actually solving a problem without having these biases. Okay, so let's imagine each student, each node, the graph is topological, of course, only topology in the end. And so I can go to any realization I want to think about, and I can think about now a two-dimensional realization, the planar graph, but I can think about the realization I have in every dimension I want to think about. Let's imagine I go to high dimensions, and let's imagine that each one of these 400 students corresponds to some location in the high-dimensional space. In this case, dimension is equal to n minus 1. The number of students minus 1 corresponds to 399 dimensions. Okay, so each student can be at any point in 399 dimensions, and each student sees all the students along different ways. So I see this student along this direction, and this student along this direction. All directions are in general independent because I'm such a high dimension. And I can do that, and I can also, high dimensions, have an analog of a polygon in which all the directions, all the edges are the same. Essentially, I just have what I had earlier, but now in high dimensions, okay? So there's no biasing, and it corresponds to a simplex that I would have in n dimensions. So this is what I would have. So if I have two students, it corresponds to one dimension, they're just along the line. If I have three students, it corresponds to b minus one, two dimensions, the triangle I had earlier. If I had four students, it corresponds to the trahedron that I also had earlier. If I have more than four students, I have now to go to four dimensions and five dimensions and so on. And so the same sort of idea that we had in the last problem, but now we just have it in this problem, and we go to higher dimensions. Okay, now what we can actually do is do this algorithm of push-pull, but now applied to students in high dimensions. Now you might ask, why would this work? If you push and pull in high dimensions, how are you ever going to solve this problem? Why is it better? In fact, it's worse because you have more coordinates to worry about, calculation will take longer and so on. It's no good. So the basic idea is that if you have push and pull forces, in those dimensions I would have essentially cancellations. I could have a situation in which I want to pull somebody in, but I have lots of other interactions which pull him out, and as a result there's some he or she is pushed out. But in high dimensions, each direction, each interaction corresponds to a ray which is independent of all others. And so there's no cancellation that occurs, or should occur, I should say, unless they all happen to collapse into a dimensional plane, which happened, actually. So in this situation, if I maintain their independence, I will not have that problem of cancellations. And each constraint will be maintained throughout the entire time evolution. Okay? And basically what will happen is that the simplex I would have that I drew here, which I can draw here in one dimension, will distort as time evolves, and distorts in high dimensions, and ultimately what I would have would be like a galaxy of students which are happy with each other, and those galaxies would push other galaxies of students which are bad, which are also mutually compatible. And this whole thing would sort of evolve in time, would expand and so on. And that's basically what I'm really after. I want these galaxies of students which are mutually compatible. So in this way, your research will actually fall on your lap. And the basic point that I said earlier a few times in words, now in equation, a simple equation, in general, the forces will never add up to zero, in general. But of course, there are many situations that will add up to zero. But in general, if you have non-coplanar points, they will not cancel each other. And so each constraint will maintain the time of time evolution. So here's a simple simulation we actually did. So these are essentially values. The C corresponds to a value of 1 if the students are compatible, and of 0 if they're incompatible. And you can see if you had only this interaction, it would like to minimize the distance between point I and point J. Student I would attract student J. They will not be together in the same dorm room. And here, there's a repulsion. If students are mutually incompatible, if Cij is equal to 0, there's a similar force now of opposite sign, and they just pushes them apart. Okay? And because you can do this on the computer, you can choose any force you want to. It's not real physics. And you might as well just choose, for instance, an overdamped dynamics. Why not? And that's what we did initially. So you have 400 points in 99 dimensions. You have this interaction, you use this force law, and you see what happens. And what happens is actually you find the answer quite easily, for most cases, but not, of course, for all cases. So we took a situation in which you have a right solution, so to speak, of 100 students, embedded in a large number of students of 400, and overall, there was a valence in average connection of 90% from the students within the same cluster. And then it was an average reconnection that we had elsewhere. And this is basically what it looks like in terms of pixels. So essentially, a white dot corresponds to a value of 0. A black pixel corresponds to a value of 1. And here you see that you have basically a solid black blob, and also a line, which you cannot see, it's too faint here along the diagonal, which corresponds to the true solution. So everywhere here, it corresponds to value 1. All these students are connected from an ideal click. Everywhere else you see there's some average connections and so on, 90%, 50%, but it's not ideal. Now you make some random permutation, you get this matrix. And now you run an algorithm, the repulsion theorem is equal to 2, and after a few steps you find the true solution, so to speak. So this works, but it doesn't always work, unfortunately. That's why it's a hard problem, of course. And you can actually try to solve easier problems, like, for instance, community detection, by which you actually have to find not necessarily perfect clicks, but find modules of nodes which have a high connectivity inside but a sparse connectivity outside. So that's called community detection. And you can actually apply this algorithm for this, and it actually works pretty well. So this is this algorithm. Dynamic symmetric evolution, this is what is drawn here. I actually probably don't have enough time to go through the details of what this corresponds to, but this is essentially the accuracy that you have. with the simulated annealing, the other method that we see does relatively well. It's not perfect, of course, unfortunately, but it does relatively well. Next step that we had, and I will run out of time very, very soon, is to do the same sort of idea, but now for discrete dynamics. So now no longer continuous evolution, but now your variables are essentially quantized, so you get only corresponding discrete values. And we wrote down a simple Potts model Hamiltonian, and the problem is really to find communities. Essentially, you want to have lots of communities, lots of links inside a community. It doesn't have to be perfect, as you can see here. There can be possibly some missing links. I'm going to click. And you want to have very few links between disjoint communities. And you want to have no links of disjoint communities. And you want to find the best situation. So you can write down a Hamiltonian which does that. So you can write down in terms of factorization of these nodes, the memberships in different communities. This corresponds to the same basic idea we had earlier, attraction and repulsion. This was written down in this context also earlier, but was very important by different by Rush and Bonhoeff. And you can actually try to find out what happened in this case. And what we actually find, so Rush and Bonhoeff actually did not have that accurate results. I mean, they have good results, but I should say they're not as good as ours. What you can actually find is this algorithm is very, very accurate. So this is our results. This is what we call absolute Potts model. And you can see it does very, very well. It essentially agrees with the annealing for Edith's cases and does slightly better than Hastings' algorithm for harder cases. And basically, it's probably the most, to our knowledge, the most accurate algorithm out there. And it's also relatively fast. It goes like the number of nodes that you have to the power of 1.3 on average. And the other case that we can actually examine, and then we have to stop in a few seconds, you can look at more complicated graphs, some new benchmarks we've proposed recently, like these ones. And again, you can do the same sort of thing. You can look at how well you solve this problem. And in fact, in this case, it solves it much better than the annealing. This is the annealing is what we do, and it actually agrees much better than so I guess here I'll have to stop and thank my collaborators on many of these things. So Lincoln Chase, in which we actually have a very critical point in the context of Coulomb's system. Vladimir Gutkov, in which we actually work in a dynamic high dimensions. Daniel Kivelson, we work in a very critical point in the last of Stephen Kivelson, who was my advisor long ago. Victor Montalegre was a student at University of South Carolina. My father, which many of you know, in which I worked on dynamics in high dimensions. A very, very talented student that I have, Peter Ronta, which we actually worked on the Potts model. We worked on the Potts model, the simulation, and that very nice ideas. Joe Rodnick, Gilles Tarjou, and Escavio. And so thank you for... Right. Right, exactly. The dimensionality is the number of components of these vectors. The number of components of a vector. Each vector has n minus one components. That's what it means. Right. That's a very, very good question, Phil. So what happens is that you find that you have more than one correlation length. So usually, what we're taught in school, so to speak, there's one correlation length, there's some exponent, depending on how far away you are from the critical point and so on. In this case, it turns out that you have more than one length. So you have one length, depending on how far away you are from where the critical point, it turns out. So if you go back to this phase diagram here, so if you go to this phase diagram here, there's actually an entire locus of points that terminates here, which is continuous, the function of kappa. For Coulomb systems, for the gauge systems, it's actually more complicated. For the Coulomb system, for many systems, what you actually find is a locus of points, which is continuous. And above this point, you have, let's say, two correlation lifts. And above it and below it, you only have one correlation lift. The number of correlation lifts changes. It corresponds to the transition you have in the complex plane, with eigenvalues changing their characteristics. And so there's actually a transition that occurs not necessarily here. There's also one here, of course, but also one here. In the case of a gauge model, I mean this model, gauge background, I should say, the number of correlation lengths is continuous. It doesn't change the function of temperature or in kappa. It's always the same. And you always have the same number of, and what can actually happen is you can have a crossover. The largest correlation length can actually change from one eigenvalue to every eigenvalue. So to answer your question, I'm not sure, but many correlation lengths in general, and also in general modulation lengths. And the total number of these is conserved as a function of temperature. And what they actually are and how they actually change depends on the model that you're looking at. But the number is conserved. And the gauge model, essentially, there are always some modulations, and there's always a large number of correlation lengths. And of course, the largest one blows up here. But you can also have a crossover depending on which one actually wins out. Which one becomes the largest of all the eigenvalues that correspond to all the correlation lengths, one of the maximal that can be transitioned in which two become degenerate when one takes off. And those transition lines, in many cases, actually correspond to loci points which terminate at this point or not. I mean, make it, in other words, it's very, very rich. Okay. Yeah. I think Gibbs is good as this. Yeah. It sounds like it's similar to Adam Gibbs, but it's not. Not quite. But yes. Exactly. So here, essentially, you see that you have, in general, what you and Kirill earlier asked, you have a few length scales. So actually, the calculation you can do in large n is exact. It's not, of course, it's large n, it's an approximation. But once you have that, it's exact. It's an approximation resolved. The original paper we had was, as you say, was some hand-waving, but it was very intuitive, but nevertheless, was some hand-waving there. And in both cases, both of them were hand-waving our analysis, which is very, very nice, and of course I'm biased, and this one, very, very, very few length scales that were involved. And you can actually calculate them exactly. And they can actually change depending on how far away you are from these lines I said earlier and so on. There's some new scaling exponents. People always talk about scaling exponents for correlation length, but also scaling exponents for other lengths, like modulation length and so on, if they want to run corrections, etc. And suppose you can actually calculate exactly. And you can see what they behave like. Now, extracting from that, the dynamics is much more challenging, unfortunately. And to that end, actually, what we can do is basically what I alluded to earlier, namely do an added given analysis of configurations, where you can calculate the replica calculations, which is essentially exact, of course, assuming that approximation of replica of Duncan in the field, or do an approximate analysis of the main wall energetics. Essentially, you say that if you want to, the main wall energetics, essentially you have a big system and you want to flip, so to speak, if you want to think about it, a few spins. And you can ask yourself, how will that actually evolve? That corresponds to some domain wall energies. There's an energy barrier. The energy barrier will depend on the length scales. And so you can actually write that form down seeing what the AI skills behave like. And that's what basically we try to do in the earliest papers. But of course, as you say, there's some approximation involved.